Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Welcome to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Today we're going to press the master of the nature documentary, David Attenborough, on one question that he'd probably rather not answer.
Are there any creatures that you can't stand?
I don't care for rats, I have to say. I've had rats leap out of the loo, so you're sitting on the loo and they come up between your thighs. That is not to be recommended either.
That's later this hour. We're going to start on another unsavory topic, but this one is hardly any joke at all. It concerns racism in government, in the past and in the present. I just read a terrific book about the history of the Ku Klux Klan called The Second Coming of the KKK, and the author, Linda Gordon, shows how the Klan, which was originally focused on violently suppressing blacks in the South, was reborn in the 1920s as a nationwide movement. And in this second iteration, the Klan targeted not only African Americans, but Jews, Catholics, Muslims, Mexican Americans, and Asian immigrants. Discrimination was the new patriotism. Linda Gordon writes how millions of people joined the Klan in the 1920s in the span of just a few years, and among them were mayors, congressmen, senators, and governors. It's a period with very sobering lessons for our current moment.
One of the things your book makes so startlingly clear is that the Klan was not something that was to the side of American political life. How can you illustrate how deeply the Klan penetrated into political office and political life? How high did it rise? Didn't go to the presidency of the United States.
Well, almost, because several presidents were, in fact, members, such as Harry Truman. But most of them, I think there were three presidents who were probably members.
Harry Truman was a member of the Klan.
Yes, he was. But as soon as he decided to move into the national political arena, he resigned.
How is that not disqualifying to his entire political career?
There's no reason at all why it should have disqualified him. This was an entirely reputable, supposedly legitimate organization. It was not the least bit secret. They advertised in newspapers. They identified themselves when they ran for office as Klansmen. But lacking polls, we can also point to the legislative and electoral achievements of the Klan. The Northern 1920s Klan elected 11 governors, 45 congressmen, and I'm not counting what were almost certainly hundreds of state, local, municipal officials.
What were their big issues? What was the legislation that Klan pushed for in the 20s?
One piece of Klan legislation had already passed, and in many ways it was the Klan's biggest victory, and that was the 1924 immigration law, the first time the federal government restricted immigration. And that law installed into our immigration policy the exact hierarchy that the Klan had of who were superior and desirable and who were inferior and undesirable, and set quotas accordingly. So there were very large quotas for the so-called Nordics, very small quotas for groups that were not white Protestants, in their view. I also think it's extremely important to remember the consequences of that act. That act remained the law of the land until 1965. It was certainly, for example, a factor that contributed to the failure of the United States to take in Jewish refugees from Nazism, because to do so, they had to work around these quotas. But beyond that, one of the Klan's main, after the march, one of the Klan's main struggles at the state level was to ban Catholic schools. They had both positive and negative arguments. The negative arguments are part of the Klan's masterful use of completely outrageously fake news. It's that the Pope set the curriculum and was trying to undermine Americans, that these young people in Catholic schools were being trained to serve as what we might call moles, to be underground. And literally, the Klan claimed that the Pope was preparing a coup to take over the government of the United States.
These are prejudices that persisted right up until the presidential run of John F. Kennedy in 1960.
Absolutely. The notion
Popism.
That if you were a Catholic and therefore honored the Pope, you could not be a loyal American.
You know, one of the things that makes your book so riveting, and it really is how absurd and self-important the Klan rituals and their terms were. You assemble a glossary of Klan titles, you know, the various officers in the Klan at the end of the book, and it includes terms like King Kleagle, and I'm going to get the pronunciation wrong, Clarigo and Clavern and Klektokin and Klanklave and, you know, everything but Covefe. And what's with these terms? I mean, you look at these guys and they're absurd hats, and you think they're laughable, and they're anything but laughable.
Well, first of all, let me say that when I wrote this book, I realized right away I didn't want to waste my time just telling people how horrible the Klan was and condemning it. I wanted people to understand it.
And you don't describe them just doing horrible things. They're at picnics and barbecues and kind of family-friendly social events and so on. There's a certain kind of Sunday in the backyard quality to some of this absurd activity.
Yes, I wanted people to understand what could be attractive about the Klan. But as to these arcane names and rituals, I think that many people, at first anyway, enjoyed being a part of the Klan because it was like being a part of a theatrical group. You were enacting a certain kind of rituals. And I might point out, many fraternal orders at the time, the Elks, the Masons, the Knights of Columbus, all had their rituals. So they were not that far out of the mainstream. But I do think, you know, when the Klan declined, it declined largely from internal causes. And one of them was, I think, that members of the Klan got a little bored with this.
But more chilling, you say that the Klan declined precisely because it had succeeded. It had triumphed in some ways. What do you mean by that?
Well, you know, I think about the Immigration Act, the eugenics, the anti-miscegenation laws, the laws passed in all the states that forbade what was then called intermarriage. But I also think that its biggest achievement is the hardest to measure, and that is their tremendous impact for a long time on public opinion. And that is that they were legitimating a discourse that was not only racially bigoted, but also religiously bigoted. And that was very, very damaging. I'm not saying that those prejudices weren't there previously, but I think it makes a big change when they come out in the open, when they are stated broadly, and when they are associated with patriotic Americanism.
Now, I don't think I'm imagining this, but as I read your book almost from the very start, almost from the very first pages, the book is imbued with a sense of we've been here before and a kind of foreboding about the present and the near future. When you think about your research on the Klan and you think about the present moment and in the era of Trump, how do you relate them?
I see a number of important themes here. One of the most important is fear. I think that that kind of anger and bigotry is best revved up by making people afraid. You find the Klan, for example, claiming that these immigrants were stealing the jobs that belonged to true Americans. But what's interesting about that is that that claim took on great strength in states where there hardly were any Catholics or Jews. For example, Oregon, which happens to be my home state. So this notion of fear and these allegations of just outrageous notions. I mean, just one example, the Pope had already landed in disguise in Washington, D.C., and was building a palace of gold, which was going to be the future capital of the United States. So fear is extremely important. Another aspect of that that does concern me a lot is gullibility. Why do people believe such outrageous things? I'm not an expert at this. I'm no psychologist. But I suspect that a lot of what you believe derives from who tells it to you Where do you hear it from? We know that thousands of ministers were lauding the Klan in their sermons, and some of them were reproducing these outrageous claims. You know, another aspect of the Klan that is of this Klan that is often forgotten, and one that is extremely relevant today, is that while many people have labeled it a populist movement, and that label has become very popular today, being a historian, I think that's very misleading, because the Klan not only had zero proposals or policies that would have helped what we might call the 99%, the sort of ordinary working class, lower middle class people who joined the Klan, but it actually lauded and honored the very, very rich.
How so?
You find statements like in some of the directions to local groups that be sure that you elect a, quote, big man to be the head of your local chapter, by which they clearly meant a man of economic and social success.
When you think right now about the base, the so-called base of Trump support, how much of that, in your mind, is related to anything that can be tied to what we're describing in the 20s? Or is it completely other? Is it completely divorced from that?
It's certainly not completely other. And I do have to point out that we don't have perfect knowledge about who joined, but we do have some good estimates. One of the things I'd like to point out as a way of getting into that is that the opponents of the Klan like to label them just a bunch of uneducated hicks, clodhoppers, people who are just dumb. And unfortunately, I see that repeated today in the way some people talk about Trump supporters. There are two things wrong with it. One is it's not true. The Klan had many educated people, people of standing in their communities, teachers, lawyers, engineers.
And presumably people who did not think of themselves as haters or hateful.
Exactly. Exactly. But the other thing wrong with that kind of thing is that it backfires.
Politically.
These disdainful put-downs of the Klan just made the Klan it made the Klan literally grow and build its resentment against these, quote, liberal, cosmopolitan, urban elites.
In a terrific review of your book in the New York Times, Clay Risen writes the following. There are two ways to think about this, meeting the Klan in the 20s. One could say, great, we've met the enemy before and defeated him. We'll do it again. Or we could realize that we've met the enemy and he is us, that the plague of xenophobia, racism, and nationalism is always present. Is this a snake? Is this an enemy, as Clay Risen puts it, that can never entirely be stomped out of American life?
It's probably true that it can never be entirely stomped out, although I would like to point out that it is not by any means exclusively American. In Europe, we see the rise of tremendously xenophobic people in the Muslim world, this kind of religious intolerance of any deviation. So one might be inclined to say, well, it's never likely to be possible to simply get rid of bigotry. But on the other hand, I do believe that it can be resisted and controlled and that it can be contained. And one of the things we see both is, you know, the rise of not only Trump, but Trumpism, but also the rise of a resistance to that. And we see in the United States today, many, many thousands of people who have never been politically active, who have never gone to a demonstration, who now feel, all right, I have to step up. I have to say something about this. So I am somewhat hopeful, but it's not going to be easy.
Linda, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Linda Gordon is the author of The Second Coming of the KKK and other books. She's a professor of humanities at New York University.
You're listening to the New Yorker Radio Hour. Today's program addresses vulgar language used by the president, which may not be suitable for some listeners.
Now, the president of the United States is by no means a Klansman, but
When the former Klan head David Duke came out in support of his campaign, Trump at first pointedly declined to disavow him. As president, he equivocated about the white supremacists who marched in Charlottesville with torches. And he recently referred to countries in Africa and Haiti, majority black nations, as shithole countries. The White House later denied the remark, but racists like Richard Spencer were thrilled that the president thought this way and that he came out and said it in a meeting in the Oval Office. It's impossible to deny that white supremacy is closer to the seat of power than it has been for generations. Andrew Morantz has been reporting for The New Yorker on the movement known as the alt-right, which includes white supremacists, Holocaust deniers, misogynists, the whole works. Some factions in that movement even model themselves directly on the Klan. And Andrew is studying how these groups hope to change political discourse, not just on the fringe, but for everyone in the United States. Andrew, Linda Gordon described what seemed to be the sudden reappearance of the Ku Klux Klan in the 20s and the way it, I wouldn't say infiltrated, it just assumed its place in American government. You had presidents who supported it, governors who were members, many members of Congress who were members, millions of people who were members of the Ku Klux Klan. Now we live in an age where the president of the United States has made it very clear what his views on race is, at least I think so. Many others do. What are we seeing here? How is this related to the phenomenon of the 20s, the rise of the alt-right and white nationalism?
I think what it shows is nothing is static when it comes to public opinion and therefore public policy. You know, we have this kind of inchoate sense that politics, you know, are based, yes, on money and lobbying and all that stuff, but they're also based on public opinion. But what is public opinion? How does it get formed? Well, if you have millions of people running around in robes and hoods, that's a sign of public opinion, right? So, you know, you bring that to the present day, the fact that you can see torches being carried in the city of Charlottesville and the statue of Thomas Jefferson being surrounded with people chanting about Jews will not replace us, that changes the discourse, right? So even if those people are fringe and even if it's a few hundred people only, people are seeing that on their TV sets and they're aware that it's a real thing. And then it enters the discourse. People have to respond to it. People have to react to it.
So there's a phenomenon that is talked about a lot lately. It's even the title of a 2010 Glenn Beck novel, a thriller, and it's called The Overton Window. What is that and how is it relevant to the discussion?
So the Overton Window is kind of a public policy sort of dry way of talking about these ideas. So there's this public policy think tank called the Mackinac Center. A guy who worked there named Joe Overton had this concept that what is possible to push in terms of public policy, if you're a representative, you can only submit bills that fall within the Overton window. So stuff that's too libertarian is too far outside to the one side, and stuff that's too statist is too far to the other side. So, you know, if you think about, you can pick any issue. If you pick gay marriage, for example, you know, very recently in public policy terms, it was literally unthinkable that marriage could be defined as including same-sex couples. And now it's pretty much unthinkable that a mainstream politician would oppose it. I mean, Donald Trump is for it. So that Overton window shifted dramatically over time. Some things shift less dramatically or even, you know, move in a reactionary direction.
But, so how does that relate to what we're talking about in terms of race and racism?
So the alt-right, the hardcore white nationalist alt-right, they see their project as pushing the window in the direction they want it to go. So they don't see themselves as a mainstream political movement where they're trying to get out a ground game and knock on doors. And they're trying to be the quote-unquote intellectual vanguard. They're trying to take the unsayable and make it sayable. So they keep saying it and saying it. So there's this idea that originates with a bunch of far-right French intellectuals that Thomas Chatterton Williams wrote about for The New Yorker. And these French intellectuals say white people in France are being replaced. There's this demographic replacement that's happening, and we are the victims of it. That idea then migrates over to the U.S. Richard Spencer and a bunch of alt-right guys pick it up, and they use this idea to kind of flip the understanding that white people have privilege and power in this country to actually say, no, white people are the victims. We're the ones being oppressed. And in fact, we are being replaced by minorities, and they even use the word white genocide. That idea is unsayable, unthinkable, totally fringe, but they keep saying it and repeating it. And over time, the people who are closer to the center of the Overton window, the more mainstream conservatives, they start picking up on it. So right after this special election in Virginia, you have Tucker Carlson, who has a been in the conservative movement for years, has a mainstream primetime show on Fox News. He gives a pretty clear nod toward this idea.
In 1970, 1% of that state was born outside the United States. Today, that number is 12%. That has made all the difference. So if you're wondering why the idea of national borders suddenly so unpopular among Democratic office holders, if you're wondering why the deadly plague of opiate addiction in middle America causes barely a stir in Washington, now you know the answer. They're not their base anymore. They've replaced you.
And after he does that, I get a text message from a white nationalist guy I've written about who says, hey, look, our strategy is working. You know, we stretch the Overton window and Tucker Carlson and others are filling their role.
Well, then how is the Overton window shifting in a real way? What's its effect on policy? In other words, how deeply is Trump and Trumpism going in changing American political consciousness?
Yeah, well, the core example would be immigration, right? There was a consensus understanding essentially since the 60s that the way we talk about immigration is we are a nation of immigrants, we are the great melting pot, diversity is our strength. Those truisms were uttered equally by both parties. You have George W. Bush saying it, you have Reagan saying it. Now, they might in practice, you know, implement different policies, but they don't question that fundamental premise. Then you have Trump coming along, and literally within 2 minutes of his presidential campaign, he has said the word rapists with regard to Mexican immigrants, right? So that is an attempt to shatter the Overton window with respect to what is sayable. There is this notion that we've had for a long time of this kind of great American consensus was the term that Kennedy used. You know, there are certain things that are outside of the boundaries of acceptable American discourse. And those things are really being put to the test.
Andrew, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Andrew Moranz is a contributing writer, and you can find all his reporting on the alt-right at newyorker.com. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. More to come.
I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
Hi, it's David Remnick. As the 2024 election draws near, it's more important than ever to understand exactly what's happening in American politics. The New Yorker offers definitive reporting and analysis by some of the best writers and political thinkers watching the campaign. Commentators and reporters, including Susan Glasser, Jane Mayer, Jelani Cobb, Masha Gessen, Evan Osnos, Ben Wallace Wells, and many more are providing incisive analysis that you don't want to miss. Subscribers get unlimited access to all of it. And we're offering a deal just for podcast listeners, 15% off a yearly digital subscription. Visit newyorker.com and use the code POD15. That's POD15. For 15% off a digital subscription to The New Yorker.
A I take out my hearing aids and put on the cans.
Right, yes, and they're on the line for you now. They're there now.
They're there now.
Yeah.
Okay, well, I can hear. Is anybody there?
Sir David, it's David Remnick from The New Yorker magazine. How are you?
How nice to meet you. How are you?
I'm terrific, and all the better for talking to you. I'm just thrilled to be talking to you. I'm David Remnick, and if you don't already recognize who that voice belongs to, it's David Attenborough. He's been documenting the world and its creatures for 60 years, and in Britain, he's often called a national treasure.
In a far corner of Southeast Asia lies the Coral Triangle, a cluster of the richest coral reefs in the world. Undersea cities crammed full of life.
Attenborough's films for the BBC, impeccably researched, ambitiously filmed, and executed with incredible style and imagination, have set the high bar for nature documentaries in our time. His latest project is a 7-part survey of the world's oceans called Planet Earth, Blue Planet 2, and it debuts this week on BBC America. It captures aspects of the animal world that we've never seen before, fish that use tools and eat birds, an octopus building itself an armor of discarded shells. And amidst our astonishment at all this, it makes you think hard about human beings and our place in the world. Sir David, I have to tell you, over the past weekend, a long weekend, I just watched and watched and watched the world of the ocean. It was an incredible experience. And over the past over the past 60 years, you've told the story of life on Earth from every continent, every habitat, and have probably documented as many animals as Linnaeus. What gives you the perpetual sense of awe about the natural world?
Well, I suppose infinite variety is what gives you awe. I mean, the fact that there is almost every problem has had more solutions to it by the evolution than you can imagine. It doesn't matter what it is, whether it's chewing vegetation or whether it's flying or whether it's concealing yourself. There is an infinity of answers that the natural history has produced. And many of them are perfectly logical. You can sort of imagine how it happened. Quite a lot aren't. And one of the great astonishments is why there are so many of them are so beautiful. I suppose we're not time to get into hoity-toity about it all, but I mean, why butterflies are so beautiful is a matter of awe.
It's a good question, and why a sea slug is so beautiful, who knew? I have to tell you, to start this conversation, I'm a confirmed city boy. I go by the terrible rubric of I am at two with nature. Nature is not something that's natural to me.
But then I'm the same. I'm a city boy. I was brought up in a city in Leicester in the middle of England. And perhaps it is the city people who haven't grown up with the natural world as intimately as country boys, for whom that perception of awe comes as so bewitching an emotion, a response.
Now, this has been 6 decades of making these films. I have to ask, of all the creatures you've seen, what sticks out in your mind as the strangest and most beautiful and incomprehensible?
Well, those are the conflicting adjectives. But one of the things in Blue Planet, which I never cease to wonder about and take joy from, is a creature called the weedy sea dragon. It occurs in the waters of South Australia. It's like a seahorse, and it swims not vertically with its body vertical, but horizontally. And it's disguised as seaweed to a simply unbelievable degree. I mean, its limbs and its flanks and its tail and its eyebrows and one thing and another, they're all like bits of seaweed. You can't tell the difference. And then they have this wonderful dance in which the male courts the female. And then the female, having got the eggs being fertilized, the female hands over the eggs to the male and he looks after them. The whole business is Disney-esque. I mean, it is quite unbelievable.
And very often there are creatures that at least in your films and in reality, perhaps, they have a real personality. At one point in this series, one of your filmmakers describes a particular octopus as having a personality. Is it like celebrity somehow? Do some animals just, you know, as they say in Hollywood, have it?
Yes, some do and some don't, and it depends on how they live their lives. I mean, it's difficult to imagine that herrings in a shoal of 10,000 can have individual personalities because they go with the shoal. But octopus in particular, which live in a solitary way for most of their lives, they certainly have personalities, and people who've actually kept them in laboratories know that perfectly well. They're artful, they're cunning. You almost wonder at times whether they've got a sense of humor.
Do they have a sense of humor? Do you think there's some wit to these creatures?
I think chimps have a sense of humor, actually. I think chimps do things just for the hell of it and see what's going to happen.
Are there any creatures that you can't stand?
I don't care for rats, I have to say. I've had rats run over my face when I'm asleep, and that's not fun.
Where did
I've
that
even
happen?
Had rats.
Not at home.
Where?
I
yeah. In the Solomons, yes, in the Solomon Islands, sleeping. Yeah, it's not too good. And I've had rats leap out of the loo, as you're sitting on the loo, and they come up between your thighs. That is not to be recommended either.
Oh, I'm having a moment. And when you're crafting a story about a creature, do you look for the animal's most essential characteristic or the characteristic which is most, you know, I hate to say the use of the word, but relatable to the person watching at home?
Well, I was going to say the anthropomorphizing temptation is great, but actually we have got over the rather simplest view of this. I mean, when I was making these films 30 years ago, the idea that you credited any animal with any emotion that you might remotely call human was anathema. I mean, you thought, mustn't do that, how unscientific. But the fact of the matter is that if you follow individual animals, which 50 years ago was not something the way in which zoologists normally worked, they generalized all the time. But when you get to know a particular animal, then you begin to realize and study them, as you do when you're making films, you suddenly realize that they are different, you know. I mean, and that's not just monkeys and apes or even octopods. That happens to me with spiders. I remember very clearly making a film about spiders, or this was 20 years ago, I suppose. This was a spider that occurs in the middle of the United States called a bolas spider, which actually it spins silk, it puts a little blob on the bottom of the thread, and then it whirls it like a bolas. I said to the cameraman, look, that's what it does, old boy. Go away and do it and film it. And in due course, I went down there. It was in Georgia, I remember. And he had a number of milk bottles. He had 10 milk bottles in a line. And he had sprigs of vegetation in each one of them. And on each one of them, there was a spider. He said, this one, he said, is absolutely hopeless. I mean, if you show her a light, she won't do anything at all. She simply won't throw a spolas. The one next to it, it's not a question of light. She hates sound. And if I make a click or something, she stops. This one is just bone idle, never does anything at all. But that one, she's absolute darling. You just put a moth anywhere near her, and she swings her bolas, and it's absolutely dead cert. You've got a great shot. Well, okay, spiders with individual personalities. Come on.
How did you first get addicted to this as a kid?
Finding fossils, I think. It's one of the mysteries, isn't it, that a lot of kids love collecting things. And it's easy to be toffee-nosed about, you know, this rather trivial, childish thing of collecting things. Actually, it's very, very important. All the great naturalists were, and natural scientists were collectors when they were boys. Darwin was absolutely obsessed with beetles. And I'm not putting myself in the same bracket as Darwin, but just collecting fossils in the Jurassic on the rocks where I grew up outside the city of Leicester, I used to find all these amazing things. I used to knock a rock with a hammer and then suddenly see it fall apart and realize that there was a most wonderfully beautiful shell, perfect in every detail, and that had not seen the light of day for 150 million years, and that mine were the first eyes ever for human eyes to fall on it. Well, that's thrilling. And then when you discover that they're not all the same, and that you can find a dozen different kinds, and that some are rare and some aren't, that's a never-ending fascination. I've never got tired of it and never cured myself.
Well, Darwin had a hammer. He had the ability to collect, but he didn't have the technology that you had in that making Blue Planet 2. What's gotten away? What animal has eluded your grasp or lens? Is there a quest still in front of you? I still want to find the fill in the blank.
I could easily have answered that question to you 30 years ago. There were dozens of things. I mean, I remember writing into a script 20 years ago, a sequence about snow leopards. All I did in those days when I was writing scripts, I wrote as though everything was accessible, as though it was just a question of application or working it out. And then when they saw it, they said, look, nobody's ever filmed a snow leopard before, ever. And it's very, very rare, and it lives in very, very remote places. And so a blue pencil goes through that lot, because you can't, there's a limit to the amount of time and money you can spend on things. But now, or not now, but a series called Planet Earth, where we have all the modern devices of tracking collars you can put on the things, we were able to get shots of this. We were able to put up, not even cameraman, we put up remote camera traps, unattended cameras, switched on by the action of this man, of the animal coming along, turning it on, taking pictures of it, spraying the rocks with urine, and then after 2 minutes when the animal had left, turning itself off. And we got a terrific sequence. So there are solutions now to almost everything you can think of. I mean, we can film at night, we can film at the bottom of the sea, we can speed things up, we can slow things down, and we can film from the air, we can film remotely. It's just extraordinary what we can do. Even, I mean, in this series, we couldn't possibly have shown sea lions trapping a tuna, because the only way you could see how they actually did it was from the air. Well, 5 years ago, we couldn't have done that. Now we have drones, and we were able to send it up and get these extraordinary shots that nobody had ever seen before of sea lions doing just that, herding in these tuna into this bay, which is a cul-de-sac.
This time, when the shoal tries to escape, he blocks them and drives them back into the next blind alley. The gang can now pick them off, one by one.
There is no doubt that compared to all of your previous work, Blue Planet 2 makes the clearest statement about the peril that the world's oceans are in. In the final episode, you say, "For years we thought the oceans were so vast and the inhabitants so infinitely numerous that nothing we could do could have an effect on them. But now we know that was wrong." When you finish this project, you and your colleagues, a lot of colleagues, do you leave it with a sense of optimism or the opposite?
I don't think that either optimism or pessimism are the most appropriate words, really, because making a global generalization is a difficult thing to do. What it leaves me with is the thought that I can see problems that have got to be solved, and I think they have to be solved. We have to face up to them and have to do something about them. And that I couldn't look my grandchildren in the eyes if they said, "Granddad, you could see that was happening and you didn't tell anybody, or you didn't do anything about it, or you didn't mention it." That would be terrible. And I have no alternative, but you have to speak about this sort of thing. And there are things that can be done. There are instances for us to realise that we can do things. I mean, after all, we have saved the whales. It was pioneers who 20, 30 years ago got together the maritime nations of the world and saying, if we go on killing whales at the rate we're doing, we're going to exterminate them. And human beings from all around the world, governments got together and said, OK, then we will actually sort out this question. And indeed, in this last programme, we explained that sperm whales, which were on the verge of disappearing, nobody knew where they'd gone or how many had gone, have suddenly come back. And around the waters of Sri Lanka, there are now actually great numbers of sperm whales, quite extraordinary, which is a marvellous demonstration that if you give the natural world just half a chance, it bounces back in an extraordinary way. That is what gives you optimism. What gives you pessimism, of course, is the fact that there are people who deny that it's happening.
Some of them are in very high office.
Some of them are in very high office.
So, David, how does this immersion in the natural world, in the animal world, in the ocean, affect your day-to-day view of human beings? How is it different than most of us walking along 8th Avenue or wherever we are?
Well, I suppose I mustn't talk about elevating or putting down. But you do realise that we're one. You do realise that the natural world, that life, this mysterious thing, which nobody's actually been able to identify, you can't define it. The difference between something that was just living 5 minutes ago and is not anymore is very difficult to define. But you know when other things have it, and you know when they don't. And we are the same, you know, from that point of view. And that's what that sort of mortality is what links us all.
I guess that's what I was going to ask. Was how does it make you view the end of things for yourself or for your friends or for humanity?
Well, you know, you're
differently.
Part of it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, the things affect you in the same way as they affect you when you see watching any other kind of animal. The closer it comes, the more you're aware of it. And people say, do you think about death? Of course I think about death. I think about death every time you get up in the morning. But it's a matter of luck, isn't it? I mean, entire luck. I have, after all, contemporaries of mine who can't walk. I have contemporaries who can't even remember things. I can't remember things, but I mean, most seriously, I can't remember things. And that is entirely a matter of luck. And so I can do these things. And not to do them, if you can do them, seems to be an act of extraordinary ingratitude.
So, David, thank you very much. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Thank you very much. Okay.
David Attenborough is the host of Blue Planet 2, which debuts this week. Now we'll turn for a moment to another great admirer of the natural world in a very different form, the poet Mary Oliver. From geese to crabs to insects to nearly an entire book about her dog, Oliver has turned again and again to animals and to the wilderness to look for meaning. A new collection of Mary Oliver's work called Devotions has just been published. Here's Mary Oliver reading from her work in 2012 at the 92nd Street Y in New York.
The summer day. Who made the world? Who made the swan and the black bear? Who made the grasshopper? This grasshopper, I mean, the one who has flung herself out of the grass, the one who is eating sugar out of my hand, who is moving her jaws back and forth instead of up and down, who is gazing around with her enormous and complicated eyes. Now she lifts her pale forearms and thoroughly washes her face. Now she snaps her wings open and floats away. I don't know exactly what a prayer is. I do know how to pay attention, how to fall down into the grass, how to kneel down in the grass, how to be idle and blessed, how to stroll through the fields, which is what I have been doing all day. Tell me, What else should I have done? Doesn't everything die at last and too soon? Tell me, what is it you plan to do with your one wild and precious life?
Ruth Franklin wrote our review of Oliver's book, Devotions, and she's here with David Haglund, the literary editor of NewYorker.com.
Ruth, I'm curious, when did you first read Mary Oliver's work? And do you remember whether you liked her work right away, or did it take a while?
You know, I don't have a distinct memory of the first time. I did have a boyfriend in college who was a big fan of Mary Oliver and pressed her on me, so I'm suspecting that must have been it. There, I did always respond to just the directness of her approach. It feels so immediate and sort of focused on you as the reader.
It's so unguarded, mm-hmm. I think. There's something, and I admit that for me, I sometimes... It sort of takes me aback. It's not what I'm used to with poetry. One of my favorite poets is Wallace Stevens, who once said that poetry should resist the intelligence almost successfully, which is just not at all her approach, I don't think.
Yeah, in general, I think that is what makes her work so almost universally appealing, is that, you know, you don't feel like you need to have a degree in poetry in order to understand Mary Oliver.
Although that's also maybe why she hasn't gotten the critical acclaim that you might expect from a writer who's won. She has won some very big prizes,
right,
and is enormously popular as poets go. But there is a kind of looking down one's nose at her from some critics, maybe. I don't know if you'd put
Definitely.
It that way.
You know, I think of them as sort of more academic poetry critics, you know, who are more interested in a kind of hermetic, almost coded kind of poetry.
Do you think that the... She's very frank about her interest in God and in prayer. And, you know, for a particular kind of secular critic, maybe that's off-putting as well.
Yeah, I think it probably is. I mean, as in the poem we just heard, This Summer Day, there's this, you know, sort of introduction to the poem where we have a nature scene with a grasshopper. One nice detail that I read somewhere in an article about her, I don't remember where now, is that there was a real grasshopper that she used as a model, as it were, for that poem. The grasshopper was eating a slice of birthday cake at a picnic, I think. So we have this little scene, and then there's an abrupt switch in the middle of the poem, and suddenly she starts talking about prayer. But, of course, you know, if you're familiar with Mary Oliver, you know that that's in the background more or less all the time.
The Summer Day is typical of her work in another way, in that it's largely about the natural world. And at least for me, living in New York City, it does feel like a window into a kind of side of life that I maybe don't get to enjoy as often as I would. And I wonder if, to some extent, people kind of feel like opening a collection of Mary Oliver is like taking a walk outside.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, I think if Mary Oliver were here with us, she would probably scold you for saying that, because, of course, it's quite possible to experience the natural world even here in New York City. You know, that's something her poetry kind of exhorts the reader to do, is to find, you know, find that moment of beauty in nature, if it's, you know, if we can call it the sublime or the spiritual or just something we might not have noticed. You know, what does she say? Attention is the beginning of devotion. That her poetic method, as she presents it, is very much about that kind of directed attention, which presumably one could experience anywhere.
Let's give the last word to Mary Oliver. Here she is reading another one of her poems, Mornings at Blackwater.
For years, every morning, I drank from Blackwater Pond. It was flavored with oak leaves and also, no doubt, the feet of ducks. And always it assuaged me from the dry bowl of the very far past. What I want to say is
that the past is the past and the present is what your life is, and you are capable of choosing what that will be, darling citizen. So come to the pond or the river of your imagination or the harbor of your longing and put your lips to the world and live your life.
Mary Oliver reading Mornings at Blackwater. The poem appears in the new collection, Devotions. We heard Ruth Franklin speaking about Oliver's work with The New Yorker's David Hagland. This is The New Yorker Radio Hour. Stick around.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
I'm David Remnick, and this is the New Yorker Radio Hour. We're going to close up today with a visit to my colleague, Troy Patterson. My new colleague, I might say. He joined The New Yorker as a staff writer just a few months ago. He's writing for us mainly about TV, but he's also been a book critic, film critic, journalism professor, and also a style editor, so I could use his help.
I'd love to know what you've been listening to, watching, wearing, drinking, eating these past freezing weeks.
My pleasure. I've mostly been eating stew.
You haven't been sick, have you?
Well, there are these children who just bring germs into my house. My own children bring germs into my house, and they escape unscathed while their parents writhe in agony.
Before we get to the, you know, high-minded cultural aspect of this, I think you have a sartorial recommendation that you want to give that's right at the end of your feed here.
What I've been wearing is Adidas Rod Laver sneakers, as usual. I have an occasion to praise the shoe because it is January, which means that the Australian Open is being played at the Rod Laver Arena. I think that people are generally familiar with the Adidas Stan Smith sneaker. It's right. this minimalist white leather one.
Right.
I am a minor member of a smaller cult that prefers the Rod Laver. As a performance item, they do not rate. They have had a following among hacky sack players. I like them because they look good dirty, but I think it's a better shoe as well.
And this is what you're wearing.
Yes.
With a foot of snow outside and it's melting and all that goop, that's what you're going to wear.
I like the way that the dirt and grime on this worn-in pair of shoes kind of rhymes with the sooty banks of snow lining the sidewalk.
They go well with the multicolored socks, too, I got to tell you.
Thank you, thank you.
So what have you been listening to and watching and all the rest?
I got sucked into this Netflix show called Easy. Have you seen this?
I have not.
It's in its second season now. It's directed and written by Joe Swanberg. Mm-hmm. It is important to note that it is like an anthology series. We're not spending our time with the same sets of people in each episode.
What would be a great episode of Easy to start with?
I am going to recommend the first episode of the new season. It is titled Package Thief. It is set in Southside Chicago in a fancy neighborhood called Beverly. The characters, these sort of like affluent white liberals in their integrated neighborhood, are having to sort of negotiate that self-conception while also finding out this criminal stealing people's Amazon packages.
Yeah, you wouldn't feel like that? Like if you were going to steal a package and you went up to the door and you saw a picture of yourself?
I mean, I'm here during the day a lot, so if I see anything sketchy, I'll call 911 in a second.
Yeah, or we could maybe just try supporting our local businesses more and stop ordering packages online.
Are you kidding? Yeah. Yes, maybe. Half.
I mean, she's definitely.
I'm just saying they're packages and they're from Amazon or wherever.
I know,
they're from.
But like some of these packages are like expensive, like the pesticides that I get.
I totally get it, but the guy's not.
If he steals that and does something with it,
I'm
on the
hook. It's not about the package itself or the contents of the package. It's we're a community. There are children here. I mean, it starts with packages. Who I just feel unsafe.
It's wonderfully closely observed. I think that because of Swanberg's trust in his actors to improvise and create a character, it helps certain kind of like anthropological texture or something. It's got a keen ear for subcultures and social niches.
Great. I'm looking forward to it. I've always liked his films. You have more for us.
You're aware that there's a Jay-Z album that came out a few months back.
After a number of albums that were kind of not his best.
I tend to agree with you. And I like the new album. And so there... appeared in December a video for a song called Family Feud. It is directed by Ava DuVernay. It is 8 minutes long.
8 minutes long is kind of crazy long for what we're accustomed to in the world of music videos over time, isn't it?
It is, but the whole thing is...
So it's extending long past the song.
The song is the payoff. You sit through a short film to get to the song. And the first half of the video gives us... sort of a futuristic saga in a matriarchal society that is a vision of what ours involves into.
Afraid of each other.
Now, ladies, it's time to discuss the Second Amendment.
If you make it illegal, you'll drive it underground.
Not want to protect themselves, not want to protect their families.
If you have to understand...
So this is the new Constitutional Convention. Already you're
winning. Yes.
Some people should have the right to bear arms.
You have distance from the person you're killing.
I understand your point. In a perfect world, it would be lovely if we could all just put down our weapons and get along, but that's not the world that we live in.
Ladies, this is just like the 13th Amendment.
It is fantastical and bonkers. I'm not even sure that it's good, but
Fantastical and bonkers was not really her style before, right? I mean, you know, we know her best for Selma and films like that, which sort of straight, narrow.
Yes, yes. Historical dramas, but she's introducing us to a new wheelhouse.
I have hope that we can shine again. We just have to remember from which we came. Family first, and always.
Super Bowl goals. My wife in the crib feeding the kids liquid gold. We in a whole different mode. Kid that used to pitch bricks can't be pigeonholed. I cooked up more chicken when the kitchen closed. We gonna reach the Philly first. I told my wife to spill your really work.
Thanks for dragging yourself down in the freezing cold. I appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me. Phonies come to a halt. All this old talk left me
confused. You rather be old rich me or new you. Troy Patterson is a staff writer at The New Yorker, and that's Family Feud from Jay-Z's new record, with a video directed by Ava DuVernay. My stash can't fit in the Steve Harvey suit. I'm clear why I'm here, how about you? Ain't no such thing as an ugly billionaire, I'm cute. Pretty much, if anybody getting handsome checks. I'm David Remnick, see you next time.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Meryl Garbus of Tune Yards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrado. This episode was produced by Alex Barron, Emily Botine, Ave Carrillo, Rhiannon Corby, Karen Frillman, David Krasnow, Sarah Nix, Michael Raphael, Mythili Rao, and Stephen Valentino, with help from Bernard Schwartz, Calla Leah, Emily Mann, and Jessica Henderson. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Tarina Endowment Fund.